Good morning. On this Shabbat, 3rd of June. Oh, is it? Oh, thank you. Who knew? Welcome to Narkeese Bible Study. And we're going to be looking today at Exodus 39, verse 33, to chapter 40, 38. Chapter 40. And then we're going to be matching that up to Isaiah 33, verse 20. Through until 34, 8. So, interesting parasha to match it with. But we'll get to that. So I'll open us up with prayer and then we can get down to reading. Lord, thank you for bringing each person here this morning. Thank you for your grace, your Shabbat. And we ask that you give us rest, your supernatural rest, and that you'd show yourself to us more, that you would clean our hearts and let us see you clearer, and let us live you out clearer in our lives. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.
So, let's go ahead and read our passage in Exodus. I don't know if anyone else is sick of the Mishkan by now, but this is it, at least for the book of Exodus. We get our final little redundant description. So, Gemma, would you like to start us off at chapter 39, verse 33?
Then they brought the tabernacle to Moses, the tent and all its furnishings, its clasps, frames, crossbars, posts, and bases. The covering of ram skins dyed red, and the covering of another durable leather, and the shielding curtain, the Ark of the Covenant law with its poles and the atonement cover, the table with all its articles and the bread of the presence, the pure gold lampstand with its robe, lamps and all its accessories, and the olive oil for the light, the gold altar, the anointing oil, the fragrant incense, and the curtain for the entrance to the tent, the bronze also with its bronze grating, its poles and all its utensils, the basin with its stands, the curtains of the courtyard with its posts and bases, and the curtain for the entrance to the courtyard, the ropes and tent pegs for the courtyard, all the furnishings for the temple, the tent of meeting, and the woven garments worn for ministering in the sanctuary, both the sacred garments for Aaron the priest and the garments for his sons when serving as priests.
So the sons of Israel did all the work according to all that the Lord had commanded Moses. And Moses examined all the work, and behold, they had done it. Just as the Lord had commanded, this they had done. So Moses blessed them.
And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, on the first day of the first month you shall set up the tabernacle of the tent of meeting. Close the ark and screen of the ark with the curtain. Bring in the table and lay out its due setting. Bring in the lampstand and light its lamps. Then put up the screen for the entrance of the tabernacle.
You shall set the altar of wood burning offering in front of the doorway of the tabernacle of the tent of meeting. You shall set the lever between the tent of meeting and the altar and put water in it. You shall set up the court all around and hang up the veil for the gateway of the court. And you shall take the anointing oil and anoint the tabernacle and all that's in it, and shall consecrate it, and all that shall be holy. You shall anoint the altar of offering, of burnt offering, and all its utensils.
You are to bring Aaron and his sons to the entrance of the tent of meeting and wash them with water. Then you are to clothe Aaron. Then you are to clothe Aaron with the holy garments and anoint him and sanctify him so that he may minister as my priest. You are to bring his sons and clothe them with tunics and anoint them just as you anointed their father, so that they may minister as my priests. Their anointing will make them priesthood that will continue throughout their generations. This is what Moses did according to all that the Lord had commanded, so he did. So the tabernacle was set up on the first day of the first month in the second year.
Okay. Great. Then,
should I go?
Sure.
When Moses set up the tabernacle, he put the bases in place, erected the frames, inserted the crossbars, and set up the posts. Then he spread the tent over the tabernacle and put the covering over the tent as the Lord commanded him. He took the tablets of the covenant law and placed them in the ark, attached the poles to the ark, and put the atonement cover over it. Then he brought the ark into the tabernacle and hung the shielding curtain and shielded the ark of the covenant law as the Lord commanded him. It's amazing. It comes out 5-7 times, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Moses placed the table in the tent of meeting on the north side of the tabernacle outside the curtain and set out the bread on it before the Lord as the Lord commanded him.
Then he placed the lampstand in the tent of meeting opposite the table on the south side of the tabernacle. He lighted the lamps before the Lord just as the Lord had commanded Moses. Then he placed the gold altar in the tent of meeting in front of the veil and he burned fragrant incense on it, just as the Lord had commanded Moses. Then he set up the veil for the doorway of the tabernacle. He set the altar of burnt offering before the doorway of the tabernacle of the tent of meeting, and offered on it the burnt offering and the meal offering, just as the Lord had commanded Moses.
Finally set up. We're rejoicing. So we're about to look at Isaiah as well, but let's just briefly recap. What part do the people do, and what part does Moses do in this section?
It says that Moses did all this.
Well, it does say at the end that Moses finished all the work, but at the beginning of our section, if you look back to verse 33, what does it say?
Where did we start 33?
Everyone.
They brought it to.
Everyone
him.
Brought it to Moses.
The material.
Well, no, it sounds like they were bringing them the finished product.
It was all in bits.
Right.
I mean, it was like putting, like going, setting up camp. I mean, you know, you've got to bring the poles,
right.
And you've got to bring the pegs, and you've got to bring the covers, and you've got to bring the beds, and you've got to bring.
So we know that Bezalel was the master designer, and Oholiab, they too were kind of in charge of a lot of the bronze work and all the technical stuff. But obviously you also need some manpower, because we're talking about a lot of things, right? So you know the people gave donations, and they obviously did some manpower as well. So why are they bringing it to Moses?
Because he had seen what it was supposed to be.
He had seen the original.
Yeah.
He had seen the, I don't know if we call it the blueprint or the, the picture.
Or the hologram.
The
NASB says.
And
the NASB says Moses examined.
He examined all the work, and he had received all the instructions.
Yeah.
So presumably he had passed those instructions on, and then to Bezalel and Oholiab, and they would have had to pass those instructions on.
Where is it?
And so anytime you have several links in a chain, you have to check that all the information went down exact. And so he inspects it all at the end. It's a big job. And
if one thinks of it in terms of modern, an architect building now, I'm no architect, but I assume there are plans and blueprints, and then somebody has to start working them all out,
mm-hmm.
you know,
sure,
some
yeah.
expert on roofs, and somebody else on floors, and somebody else on
yeah.
cupboards. And then the architect wants to look at it and approve that actually it's like it should be.
Yep, that's right. So that's Moses' job. But it's also interesting because later on we hear everybody has a job of what part to carry, right, in the book of Numbers.
Mm-hmm. We've got it today.
And yet here, who sets everything up initially?
It's the wonderful question no one actually has an answer to.
Well, I mean, it has Moses doing it here.
Yeah.
Moses is running around taking all the things and
totally impossible
for one person to have done it alone.
Done it by himself. Unless he was an angel or had supernatural suddenly strength, but because you had huge curtains.
Well, sure. I mean, you could also say if Moses was involved in every aspect of the setting up, he could have had helpers, and they just don't focus on them. They're focusing on the fact that it's Moses doing it.
It's more to do with the placing.
He's
directing
it, at least. At the very least, he's directing.
He's directing, but he's placing the things as the Lord commanded, whether it's the table, or whether it's the tablets of the covenant, or whether it's where the lampstand goes. I mean, he's the overseer of how it all gets put in place.
Verse 42 says the sons of Israel did all the work.
Uh-huh. Everything that God commanded Moses.
Read it again.
They did it. In verse 42 of chapter 39. And then in verse 43.
But 42 I've got.
What?
Had done all the work. The Israelites had done all the work.
They did all the work.
Well,
sure. Because at this point in the chapter, they've already brought all the stuff to him. So it's something they had already done because the stuff is there. And Moses looks at the work, and behold, they did just as God commanded, and he blessed them. What does this verse remind you of?
Which verse is that?
Verse 43.
Genesis.
Yeah. Genesis, yeah, the end of creation. Who wants to read the last verse of the first creation story from Genesis chapter 2?
To what?
2:1-3, basically.
The heavens and the earth were completed with everything that was in them. By the seventh day, God finished the work that he'd been doing, and he ceased on the seventh day all blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it he ceased all the work that he had been doing in creation.
Mm-hmm. So you have that same kind of redundancy, and you have the word melacha. We've mentioned it before. Melacha is
work.
Occupational work.
What kind of work?
It's your occupation.
Oh, occupational.
Occupational work. It's also craft work.
Can you write it up again for me?
Melacha. Do you like it in this?
Yeah.
And avodah is also listed here. Avodah is worship. Most of the time in the Bible, this is used for worship, but it's also work. This one is work. When you ask someone, where do you work? It's craft. It's like when the sailors on the boat ask Jonah, where are you from? What's your name? What people group are you from? What's your job? Right? They use this word. Ma melachtecha. What's your melacha? Now, repeatedly throughout the tabernacle, melacha is describing the craft work, all the work that goes into making this tabernacle. And, of course, that's the word that is used in creation. And this is a word of what you're not supposed to do on Shabbat. So when people come from other languages and they say, well, what's the big deal? That's not work. Well, it depends how you define work, what word you're starting from. Because if in your mind, work is only stuff that makes you sweat, well, that's one definition. But if you're reading the text, it's this that's not allowed. So then you have to decide, well, what about melacha isn't allowed? And you have to grapple with that. Is it whatever you're doing as a job you shouldn't do on Shabbat? Because it's your occupational work? Or is it any kind of craft you shouldn't do on Shabbat? By the way, I go with that. I go with this interpretation. But Judaism has gone with this as well, obviously that, but craft work, and they have a whole list, and they actually base the avot melacha, the categories of this kind of craft work, on what was done in the tabernacle. So that's why you can't cut things on Shabbat. So there are certain categories you can't do on Shabbat. So it all comes down to how you interpret this word melacha, and it's connected to creation, and it's connected to creation of the tabernacle.
It's interesting, because I have a very good friend, a very Orthodox friend, who is an avid knitter.
Mm-hmm.
And she's not allowed to knit on Shabbat.
Right, because it's this creative work,
it's a
or
creative
craft work.
Yeah.
I do the opposite. I'm not going to work on Shabbat. What I normally do is work. Now, if you were a painter, and your normal work is painting, like that's how you earn a living, I would say then take a break on Shabbat. Don't paint on Shabbat. But if my normal work is sitting staring at a computer screen and doing all these books, well, I'm going to paint on Shabbat, you know? Because that is not work for me. It's not something I'm earning a living from. But this all comes from my interpretation of what about melacha is not supposed to be done on Shabbat? Anyway, so I just point that out for all the connections between passages as you read the words, what it naturally connects you to. So this little ending of the tabernacle, getting everything together. In fact, I didn't write down the verse, but it even used the word kilah at some point. You guys can find it for me. But kilah, he finished. Now I've just switched for you. Look at that. Or let me be consistent. He finished. The heavens and the earth were finished, uses this. God finished them, this word. And somewhere in our passage, there was a word, kila. So there are several links that kind of bring you back. And plus the redundancy of everything that he finished to do. Like the verses you read from Genesis seem very redundant. And Moses checking is very kind of scrupulous, let's say. And notice Moses blesses them. So, what does it say? Yeah, and he blessed them. I read that to say the people coming. I guess you could also bless the stuff they brought, but no, I think it's the people. So that also connects us to Genesis, right? Because what does God do? He finishes his work, and then what? In Genesis, at the end of creation, he finishes the work, then what does he do? He blesses it. Well, he makes it holy and he blesses it. So it's interesting here, you have the finishing of the work, bringing it in, and now Moses blesses the people. Like, where did that come from? What?
He blessed the seventh day and made it holy.
Right, that's right. The Shabbat was blessed.
So
here the people are blessed, but you still have a blessing given after completing a bunch of melacha.
Right.
So that would be a connecting part. Maybe he just said, good job. Like, great, guys, you did it right.
Yeah.
A blessing can be anything positive. Okay. Look also at Exodus 40, verse 2. When is the tabernacle set up?
First day of the first month.
Okay. First day of the first month. Of what?
Well, month of Nisim or Aviv.
Sorry, I didn't hear what you said. And C. It also should say, doesn't it say also the second year? Where is that?
Oh, yeah. The first day of the first. I
it
said
did
it.
Says
it did say it.
Yes.
It said it at the beginning.
On the first day of the first month. It just said
it. I think
no,
it said
I
the second
it
year or
something
else.
It's in our passage. It's amazing.
17.
Verse 17? Okay. And it was in the first month of the second year.
Where are you now?
Verse 17 of chapter 40. So, what's the first month?
Nisan.
Why?
Pesach.
In the Pesach commandment, it said this will be the first month. And basically, you count the year from when you were released from Egypt. Forever. Like, that's how the year starts for you. So the people of Israel become a people in Nisan. Become a people at Passover. Because that's when they were brought, kind of they got their identity. They're brought out of Egypt, set up as a people. And that's a cyclical thing every year. But what does it mean, second year?
They were ready for a year.
They've been out for a year. So we're counting the years also. We're not just counting the months by Nisan every year. We're counting the years by when you come out of Egypt. It's pretty powerful
again,
when you think about it.
Yeah.
We're counting the years. The fact that this is a second year means you've started counting since you left Egypt. That's for you now the way you're counting years.
Okay.
It just to me points out what a huge deal it is in terms of it's like the world begins for you.
Yes.
You know, your identity as a nation. That's when it starts, in leaving Egypt. Even though they had an identity as a nation before that, right? They had the fathers. But like this is the real thing.
So when they say it's year 5866 or something nowadays, are they
no,
off
that? No, they're not.
That's supposed to go back to
but you could
years.
Argue that they should.
Yeah. It's similar.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm celebrating now 30 years since my Aliyah, and it like changed my identity.
Yeah.
I mean, one could argue it's the same with birthdays, but birthdays
well,
not quite the same.
What?
But I think we have this.
Whether you call this CE or AD, what is zero? What is that based on? The creation of the world?
No.
What?
Birth of Christ.
birth of Jesus. Somebody calculated when they thought Jesus was born, and that became zero, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's the same concept. Something so huge in history that that becomes your starting point to number things by. So now their zero was the Exodus, and now they're starting their second year since then, and they finally get a tabernacle set up. What are the laws that they've had before this? I mean, this is all given in Mount Sinai, so what have we been reading about?
How to set up the temple, or how to set up...
A lot of laws, how to set up the tabernacle. There are also some extra laws,
yes.
But obviously the Ten Commandments are the big laws. And
there's some other laws about...
And then
any
instructions they previously got in the way out of Egypt. So the first one was during the manna and quail. They were told not to work on Shabbat. So that's a pretty dominant one, because you get it, creation leads up to that. You get it in the man and the quail way before you even get the Ten Commandments. Then you get it in the Ten Commandments. And it's very interesting. I want to go there too at some point. I was challenged to write down all the verses I want to mention today though. But one thing, as it comes to the glory of the Lord being revealed, that actually also connects us back to the manna and the quail. And that's quite amazing, because what are the big events so far that they've seen the glory of the Lord? Before we get to this chapter where God comes into the tabernacle. Just off of your memory, when does God like show up in a big way?
Ten Commandments.
Let's use this as a zero point. Since the zero point,
crossing the Red Sea,
right?
That's actually, the night before they crossed the sea, there was
the cloud.
The
cloud that was fire gave light to one side and darkness to the other. It's like this mysterious, I don't know how that worked. Or were there two layers, or was it shimmery? And that same cloud somehow allowed the Egyptians to go in the morning. It kind of blinded them. It says it. God stared down at them from the cloud. So you have this presence of God in a cloud, some kind of fire, bright light, the night before crossing the sea, then crossing the sea itself. And then, when's the next glory we see of the Lord?
The water. Giving them water to drink. Was that the next one?
The manna. The manna's before that, yeah. If you look back in chapter 16. It says in chapter 16, verse 7. Well, it's poetic. I have to start in the beginning. In the evening you will know that the Lord has brought you out of the land of Egypt, and in the morning you will see the glory of the Lord, because he has heard your murmurings against the Lord. So whatever miracle is going to happen, it's supposed to show them that God brought them out of Egypt, and it's a revelation of his glory. It's going to be something miraculous. It's not just a little thing. And so let's jump down to the description. Who can find it? Chapter 16 is quite long. Okay. So the description of how it actually plays out kind of sounds normal, right? If you look at verse 13 of chapter 16 of Exodus, in the morning there was a layer of dew around the camp.
16, which verse?
13. 13. 13 and 14 and 15. So, interesting. Like, we have mention of God's glory, but you don't really see a big cloud in this case. What do you see?
Do you see this manna on the ground?
Do you see a layer of dew that becomes manna? I don't know, maybe there was a sudden transformation that could have been cool if that happened.
Like promised. Thin, flaky substance is what this one says.
But it seems like here the glory of the Lord is the result of what he does, not necessarily a big, shiny thing. But in either case, the glory of the Lord, the effect is that it has a certain awe, like people wonder, or they're afraid of it even, because they see the power. So at least here we have the Israelites asking, you know, what is this? And of course, that's a play with the name man. We say manna in English. Manhu could be an old way of saying mihu.
What is it?
Yeah.
Kind of like Maze.
Okay, so we can go back to our text. But that was the glory of the Lord. And of course, the glory of the Lord on Mount Sinai, the giving of the law. And in that case, it was, what do you think it looked like? Was it shiny? What was the glory of the Lord on Mount Sinai?
It was dark cloud.
It was dark. Mm. And what else?
And thunder and lightning.
Thundering, lightning.
They could see the thunder.
Also, did it mention lightning?
Yeah.
It describes
yes.
lightning, yeah. And so basically a storm, a really bad storm.
But it doesn't say it rains.
True. Just thunder, lightning.
Yeah,
and,
I mean,
but it says the whole top of the mountain was burning.
Yes,
so it seems
fire.
Like lightning struck the top of the mountain kind of thing. That's a picture you get in your mind. And it's very foreboding. It's very scary, actually. It's not like this shiny, pretty light thing. It's
if you've been out where clouds are rolling in and everything's getting really dark and there's lightning all around and there's no rain, and you're wondering, where'd the sun go?
So what do you think, what kind of glory filled the tabernacle? Was it a thick, dark cloud? Was it shiny?
Well, it says it was thick enough that they couldn't enter.
Right. That's kind of weird, huh? Because darkness you can still kind of go inside of.
So it's something like
feeling of denseness, isn't it?
Yeah. There's a feel
a dense
of
cloud.
Power or something there. What were you going to say back there?
It does say then the cloud covered the tent of meeting, so I mean, I'm assuming it's the same cloud that's been leading them
right.
by day, night, and all that stuff before. So.
Even though it doesn't mention the pillar.
Yeah.
Which is interesting because before when Moses pitched the tent outside the camp, the pillar came down and stood in front of it. Mm-hmm. So you kind of have this idea that there was this, like this big pillar that kind of like whoop, like went over there and stood right in front. Where now it kind of dissolves and like goes right over the whole thing.
So it is the presence of the Lord.
Yeah, it shows the presence of the Lord, absolutely. And we're trying to imagine what that would have looked like and felt like if you were there watching it with your eyes.
I kind of imagine it like a heavy fog that just descended and you couldn't see the thing that you knew was right there in it, and yet you could see the all around it.
Right.
It had a boundary. I remember
yeah.
the great fog in London, and you literally couldn't see a hand in front of you, and we had to get off the bus that we were on because nothing could move and walk back. And it was really scary.
Yeah.
You were walking, you couldn't walk, you were walking into fog.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So there's like a thickness.
But this has got a boundary to it.
Yeah.
Right, and you couldn't
yeah.
go in because
yeah.
God's glory
yeah.
was there. In Ezekiel, do you remember the first chapter of Ezekiel?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Ezekiel kind of combines a lot of these ideas. You can look at the very beginning of the first chapter. Look in verse 4. What does he see?
Windstorm coming from the north, an
mm-hmm.
enormous cloud with lightning flashing.
such that bright light rimmed it and came from it like glowing amber from the middle of the fire.
Okay, so we have a ruach se'ara, we have a big windy storm, we have a great cloud, and we have fire. How did you...
This is lightning flashing.
A bright light rimmed it, it says. Esh mit lakachat.
Yeah, the center of the fire looked like...
This reminds me of the plague in Egypt where the hail comes down. Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
There's also fire in the hail,
mm-hmm,
somehow. How you see that, I don't know. Was it that lightning came with the hail? But it describes it with esh mit lakachat. Either igniting fire, or you want esh mit lakachat? Esh mit lakachat. If you look back in Exodus, in the hail, you'll find that also. And we have the word noga, which is the bright shining, basically. And that it's what stars normally do. So noga's around it. So you have storm, fire, and a shining brightness. And from inside of it, ke'ena chashmal. What is chashmal today?
Electricity.
Electricity. That's right. So how does it translate there for you?
Are you in Ezekiel still?
In Ezekiel, yeah. Verse 4. You read glowing amber, right? Wasn't that what you read?
Came from it like
glowing metal.
Amber from the middle of a fire.
Yeah. Glowing amber.
Glowing metal.
Yeah.
I like electricity. Now, further on in chapter 8, there's also...
I have a note that I wrote down that it could have come from the Akkadian word eshmedu, which was like a type of shining metallic stone.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Could have come from what, Daniel?
A shiny metallic stone.
Which word are we talking about?
Chashmal.
Oh, chashmal.
There's an Akkadian word that's eshmedu.
And the Septuagint translated it electron. You hear electron? And they describe it as an alloy of silver and gold, perhaps envisioning in comparison to the glow of molten, like when metal is molten, it kind of shines. Something pretty cool. I mean, it would be very hard if you were an artist to try to...
I don't think cool is the right word.
No, you're right. Awesome. How about that? Now, further, I'm not seeing it just now, but there's also rainbows coming out of it from the clouds. So this is Ezekiel's picture of the glory of the Lord, basically. And he later on has this glory also fill the temple. When else does the glory come down? We just read about the tabernacle. What would the next place be?
We're still within the Exodus sanctuary?
No, in
the temple.
In the temple.
Yeah.
In the temple, when Solomon...
When Solomon prays, and what links our passage to the temple passage about the glory filling the house?
It's the building and its completion. And
yes,
all
with the completion.
Right.
And also says there, the priest can't get in because the glory of the Lord filled it.
Yeah.
So it's this like, you can bump into the glory. I mean, you can't, it's thick. It's pretty amazing sounding. I don't know if all our special effects could quite give us the right idea. So we have this picture, this huge event, glory filling the temple. We need to read Isaiah 33. All these pictures in our mind and ideas of what we've read about. And now we're going to read and say, why on earth did they connect this passage to Isaiah 33:20? So, do you want to start us off again, Gemma?
Yeah, sure. Isaiah 33:10-20.
Mm-hmm.
Look on Zion, the city of our festivals. Your eyes will see Jerusalem, a peaceful abode, a tent that will not be moved. Its stakes will never be pulled up, nor any of its ropes broken. There the Lord will be our mighty one. It will be like a place of broad rivers and streams. No galley with oars will ride them. No mighty ship will sail them. For the Lord is our judge. The Lord is our lawgiver. The Lord is our king. It is he who will save us.
Your tackle hangs slack. It cannot hold the base of its mast firmly, nor spread out the sail. Then the prey of an abundant spoil will be divided. The lame will take the plunder, and no resident will say, I am sick. The people who dwell there will be forgiven their iniquity.
Now chapter 34, verse 1.
34? Huh.
Yeah.
Come here, ye nations, to hear, and to hearken, ye people. Let the earth hear, and all that is therein, the world, and all things that come forth of it. For the indignation of the Lord is upon all nations, and all fury upon all their armies. He had utterly destroyed them. He had delivered them to the slaughter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, go ahead and keep reading. Mike?
Okay. So their slain will be thrown out, and their corpses will give off their stench, and the mountains will be drenched with their blood, and all the hosts of heaven will wear away, and the sky will be rolled up like a scroll. All their hosts will also wither away as a leaf withers from the vine, or as one withers from the fig tree.
For my sword has drunk its fill of the heavens. Behold, it descends for judgment upon him, upon the people I have devoted to destruction. The Lord has a sword. It is sated with blood. It is gored with fat, with the blood of lambs and goats, with the fat of the kidneys of rams.
In Borzah,
a great slaughter in the land of Edom.
Wild horses shall flee in dread, young bulls with mighty steers, and their land shall be drunk with blood, their soil shall be saturated with fat.
And one more.
For it's the Lord's day of retribution, the year of vindication for Zion's cause.
Yeah, so it continues. We have some strange metaphors here. But what links us up to our passage, first of all?
That first verse.
The first verse. What about the first verse?
The reference to the festivals, a tent,
okay.
The stakes, the ropes. These are the things that held the tabernacle.
Yeah, so we have stakes, a tent, ropes, and it's talking to Zion, and it's calling Zion Kiryat Moadenu, the city of our Moadin, which are what?
The festivals.
Festivals. Moed is any set time, right? But this is another word for festival. But it's also the word Ohel Moed, right? The tent of meeting. It's the tent of the appointed meeting place or appointed time, right? So that word Moed could also link back for us because in our parasha we've had Mishkan, which is the dwelling place of God, and the parallel is Ohel Moed, which we saw before actually describes two tents. It describes the tabernacle, what we call in English, and it also describes the tent of meeting that was outside the camp. And some people like to make it the same thing, but I just don't know how that works because they're totally different. I mean, the tabernacle has to be holy, and outside the camp was definitely not pure, holy in the sense of pure. So,
also in the sense of being set apart.
Right.
It's different.
Yeah, it's different. It's pure. There's a ceremonial purity. There's a whole system.
Right.
And everything outside the camp is not that. It's impure. And so you couldn't put a tabernacle outside the camp.
Right.
It would be impure. That goes in the middle. So the tent and the outside of the camp would have been a different kind. But it was a meeting place with God. It's the pillar went there.
Yeah. I guess I always kind of thought that you set that up
before
in the year before the tabernacle came, because he needed a place away from everybody who was working. Moses needed a place to meet God.
Yeah, but even if it were before a tabernacle, you're saying to get away from the dirty camp.
Yeah, to get out of the camp itself.
Because the idea is the camp becomes...
on the mountain.
Right.
To me.
But the camp becomes clean because of God's presence in it. I guess if you say it's before, one comes before the other.
Yeah, I don't know. It's just, I was thinking about this because the pillar was out there and met him at the tent of meeting.
Mm-hmm.
But once the Mishkan set up, the pillar moves there and stays there, and every
in the
time
middle.
The pillar moves,
or
they
lifts
have
up.
To move the lifts up.
Yeah.
They have to move the camp. So
right.
I guess I kind of feel that once the Mishkan was set up, the tent of meeting was
not functional anymore.
Yeah, not necessary.
Yeah, I guess I mean it's all boils down to how you interpret it.
Yeah.
Sure.
But the interesting thing is, in the Exodus reading, it's focused on Israel and what Israel is doing and her relationship with the Lord and her experience of the Lord and so on. And then now we're getting the switch, come near you nations and listen.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the judgment that's coming on the nations.
Well, it's still focused on Israel. It starts in Jerusalem. Like all our parashot seem to connect us back to Jerusalem.
Right.
But notice also, what does it say about this tent? In Zion.
A peaceful settlement.
And the next line?
A tent that stays put.
That's strange, right?
A tent that
an immovable tent.
Is in an actual.
It's verse
well,
20.
Why do we use tents? We use them in cases when we're not intending to stay there forever. That's why we have a tent. That's why we don't build a house out of stone. So it's movable. So it's kind of a strange metaphor. This is an immovable tent, but it's still a tent.
It kind of goes back to David's tent, because David set up a tent.
David set up a tent, but Solomon built the house. But the tabernacle is kind of the opposite, where it is movable.
Mm-hmm.
When Moses, if you remember the order, when he's setting up everything for the tabernacle, they bring all this stuff. What does he start with?
The ark.
The ark. He starts with a very pearl in the middle, right? And what does the ark have in it?
The tablets.
Yeah, okay, so the very first thing he puts in the testimony of the covenant, right? Then what does he put in?
This stick of the stuff of iron.
Then he puts in the badim,
the staves.
The long rods.
The poles.
Which are for what?
Carrying.
So the idea is this is a mobile throne. This is a mobile temple. It's not going to stay here forever. And he covers it with a kaporet. And then once he gets that whole tent thing set up, you know, it's holy. And basically at that point, people can't go back in to see it.
But hang on, which bit? It's the Mishkan, which is carryable.
Yeah.
But the tent itself is a bit more of a balagan. I mean, you've got to up.
I mean, it's
tent.
Still a huge deal to set up a whole tent. That would take a lot of effort and time.
But you can walk around with a Mishkan on your shoulders.
Well, not one person.
No.
But that's why you have numbers where everybody has a certain thing to carry. And certainly you can carry the ark.
Mm.
But there's this difference in metaphor. Once you get to the temple, it's not movable at all. And we can go back and read it. I didn't read it this morning. But I believe that in the temple, they don't have the bars in the ark anymore. They come out. It stays there.
It's interesting, though, because, like, you know, it's movable because they're meant to be moving.
Yeah.
But this moving is not like the ideal situation. They're meant to be heading somewhere.
Right.
Right. So, and yet when David wants to build a house, you know, God says, you know, who are you to build me a house? You can't, you know, I can't be contained.
I've been living in a tent the whole time till now.
As if to imply like that, you know, was good enough, you know.
Right, right.
Yet, but that's also a paradox because, you know, I'm God, you can't contain me in this little thing.
Yeah.
So like, there's this constant tension
mm-hmm.
all the time, both when they're moving and both when they're not moving. None of these situations are ideal or complete.
Right.
They're always sort of incomplete representations.
Representative.
They're always sort of imprecise.
And yet you could say that the temple is the culmination of the tabernacle in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's what it was leading to. Yeah, definitely.
But even the temple is also still not complete, like
mm-hmm.
not a complete representation of who God is, because God is not contained just in these walls. Like he's everywhere. Like, yes, this
yeah.
represents who I am, but only a bit of me. I'm much bigger than this. Remember, I'm much bigger than this. I'm not just here. I'm everywhere.
Right. Right. And yet that concentrated glory seems to be for the temple. Although in the prophetic idea, it actually extends to all of Jerusalem from
mm-hmm.
the temple.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why no one is going to say they're sick.
Yeah.
People living around there, no one's going to be sick, and they're going to be forgiven. And lame are going to get plunder. Which is interesting, because if lame are getting plunder, it means everybody else has already gotten the plunder. It means there's so much plunder, there's enough left over for the very slow people to drag themselves and get something.
We've also got, where it says the sins of those who dwell there will be forgiven, the implication is that there is a humility or a repentance for sin, rather than the response to the glory of God. You can't go in. I mean, you're falling on your face, whatever.
Right.
Who am I, you know?
Right.
Cleanse me, Isaiah 6.
Right, yeah, that's always a response, to be cleansed.
It's not just, oh, well, you know, everybody's
yeah.
okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And then that follows forgiveness. Look, also in verse 21, there's this, the rivers.
Yeah.
So do we have rivers around Jerusalem?
Not yet.
Oh.
Not yet? There is a tradition that, well, Hara Moria is the temple, right? And there's a tradition that was also the Garden of Eden. If you remember, there's four rivers that goes out from the Garden of Eden. It's interesting here, they say it's a place of rivers and Yeorim. Yeor is actually the name of the Nile River. And so here they translate it streams. But it's interesting because it's kind of reminiscent. Rivers and Yeorim together. Yeor is one of the four rivers that comes out from Eden in Genesis 2. So so kind of is reminiscent of the Garden of Eden there, that has the rivers coming out. And they're going to be wide, but not wide enough, I guess, for ships and big army galleys to come through. And then we all of a sudden shift. What's the next metaphor? We've moved from a stable tent that's never going to leave to...
To a boat.
You're like, that's kind of random. I mean, you mentioned the rivers, and we also, I guess, have the connection of the chavalim, the ropes. There's ropes in a tent, and there's ropes on a boat.
But it says, no galley with oars will ride them, no
right.
mighty ships will sail them. So whatever these rivers and streams are,
it reminds me of...
They're not ready for...
They're smaller. They're small.
They're either smaller or...
Or they're just
man
protection.
Man is not going to do his own
right.
thing on it.
Right, because the Lord will be there.
It reminds me of the river that's going to form from the Temple Mount.
Right,
to
the
river.
Right, to Zechariah. Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
Zechariah 14, where it splits. Havitzophim will split, and water goes down the watershed, some to the Dead Sea, some to Yamal Gadol. So then we have, what is this image of a ship? What is that supposed to be for us? What is,
a
he
life.
Starts describing a ship. What is this? What
our
is
lives.
A what?
Our lives.
Our lives? Okay, but when Isaiah is talking, he's talking at the beginning of the verse 20, who's he talking to?
To Zion.
He's talking to Jerusalem, right?
Yeah.
To Zion, yeah. So, and he's describing something in the future, that you're going to be this tent that's immovable and your ropes are going to be secure. But now your ropes are not secure. Now you're not a tent. You are a boat. You're a ship. So you're wandering around, but you're an abandoned ship. Your mast isn't secured, and your ropes are slack. And so I guess the connection there, he uses two metaphors, and he needs those. Maybe he describes Jerusalem as a tent because he has that rope imagery that can serve for both metaphors.
Could it refer us to the expulsion of the Jerusalemites?
Yeah, it seems to be. Seems to be referring to exile. But then he goes back to describing the future time. At that time, you have a great quality of loot. So you're going to be a winner in some kind of thing. Just like when they left Egypt, they got loot. They got plunder from the people before they left. And then this thing that no one's going to be ill. And they're going to have their sins forgiven.
I'm finding the connection between the two very hard to grasp.
Right. It's kind of very out there.
It's an interesting thing to look at and try and work out what Isaiah's saying. But what's the connect? I really, apart from Jerusalem being pictured as the city of our festivals, Moed, and the tent. After
the tent becomes the temple, becomes secure.
Right.
So the mention of a temple and a secure structure in Jerusalem, I think, as opposed to this mobile one in the desert, is kind of the connecting force, besides a couple of the words mentioned, like Moed. But yeah, it is a rather strange connection.
Mm-hmm.
It's very, you would say, loose. It's loosely connected. And then you get to this whole, why did they include Isaiah 34 in it? Because it seems so different. All of a sudden you're not talking to Jerusalem, you're talking to all the nations out there. And specifically what nation?
Edom.
When does Edom become a player, let's say? What time in history?
Well,
before, okay, well, way back. You're right, well, there's a long history, but... But I'm thinking politically, in geopolitics.
I think it's a factor today.
Oh,
is
okay.
It?
Well, let's not jump to today.
But
let's go stay in the Bible.
So I don't know what you mean.
In David's time, they're kind of allies, right? I mean, in some ways, David has connections to them. It hasn't really crystallized into us and them.
Well, during the Exodus...
They didn't let them go through their land, that's right.
They didn't let them go through their land.
That's right.
They were an enemy at that point.
It's interesting, if you follow the Bible, if you're looking at the different time periods, in the beginning, Edom's a brother, right? He's a twin brother.
Mm-hmm.
It says, don't despise an Edomite because he's your brother, so you're not allowed to hate them. They're kind of, he's this ambiguous character, if you look at Esau and Edom. And it's kind of like when Judah's up, Edom's down, Edom's up, Judah's down. There's that kind of relationship. But it starts getting really bad around the exile, because Edom basically was a traitor to Israel when the Babylonians came in. They sided with the Babylonians. So anything you read about Edom from the exile on, how are they going to talk about Edom? They're just the worst thing in the world. They are the enemy. And when you read Isaiah 34, it definitely sounds like that. Which is why some people think chapter 34 actually is in the same time as 40 and on. Kind of, it's been the prophecies have been reordered, basically, maybe more thematically or something, where this, originally, this prophecy was from much later. Prophecy tends to relate to the time the people are in. It can have future extrapolations as well, but usually when God gives a prophetic word, it's for the hearers to hear now. There's some meaning for them to hear now. So,
but it's also relevant, for the Lord is a day of vengeance, a year of retribution to uphold Zion's cause,
And that links with Isaiah 60, that the nations or kingdom that will not serve you will perish. It will be utterly ruined.
Yeah, totally. I mean, that's what I'm saying. Chapter 34 lines up very much with prophecies more in what some people call 2nd Isaiah or 3rd Isaiah, like the later chapters of Isaiah. And they line up historically with kind of the punishment that Edom will get for betraying Judah. And that happened during the exile. Isaiah ben Amoz lived when? Just give me a ballpark figure. When did Isaiah ben Amoz live?
Oh, he was around
8th century. Mid-8th century, right? So this is kind of before Edom becomes this big evil player. But Isaiah and his school of prophets and the people, whatever disciples he had that probably wrote in his name, they would follow in his footsteps. And maybe it was someone like that who may have written the later chapters of Isaiah. We don't know, because the way books were written in the ancient world is, if a book is famous, you second yourself to that. It wasn't the same as we have with our copyrights today, and every little person could go self-publish their own book. That's not how things happened. So we won't get into all the intricacies of Isaiah, but here it clearly is talking about Edom as if Edom needs to go to hell. I mean, you see images of war and apocalyptic images. The sky is rolling up like a scroll. And if you notice the stars, it says will fade away. The stars are actually going to rot. And the hills are going to dissolve in their blood. So there's so much blood that the hills will dissolve. Like when you put a lot of water on a little dirt, it kind of just dissolves away. So that's quite a nasty picture. And we kind of stopped in the middle of it. But I think the idea is this, the last verse in verse 8, that God has planned a day of revenge, a time when he will repay Edom for her hostility towards Zion. So there's this idea that God is going to orchestrate things. God will be in charge of a punishment for the person here typified by Edom, but it could be anybody who was opposed to Zion. So how this little chunk ties into our parasha is very loose, yeah, for sure. But I think the main connecting thing is just the tabernacle and Zion. And maybe the fact that we were talking so much about the glory of the Lord filling in people's mind, that connects you from the tabernacle story to the temple story. And then once you have the temple, then this Isaiah prophecy becomes relevant.
And it also connects to what we are anticipating of the glory of the Lord filling there.
Yes, Isaiah anticipated that the glory would cover the whole earth, just like waters cover the sea.
Yeah.
Interesting. So keep mulling on it. We're a little over time, so you're welcome to come downstairs to the worship service. Shabbat shalom.
Thank you very much.